I don't think there's a significant amount of cardiovascular disease that's clinically meaningful for humans that happens independent of insulin resistance. And that insulin resistance may just not be diagnosed. On this week's episode of the podcast, I spoke to Michael Twyman. He's a board-certified cardiologist. And I started by asking him about my blood lipids. What do you think about my lipids, Mike? And what do you think about my cardiovascular risk? We then got into a really interesting conversation about ApoB and cardiovascular risk, oxidized LDL, Lp(a), Lp(PLA2), seed oils, all kinds of crazy stuff in this podcast. Maybe not crazy, just very crazy interesting to me. So enjoy this one. It's technical at times, but I think this is a very important topic. I talk about LDL, cholesterol, cardiovascular risk all the time, because when you are eating an animal-based diet and avoiding seed oils, polyunsaturated fat-rich seed oils, and you're eating animal foods with saturated fat, often LDL will go up. The last couple of times I've checked my LDL, it was 165 milligrams per deciliter. I actually just got a test of blood work when I was in the United States last week. My LDL is now 130 milligrams per deciliter, so it's coming down a little bit. But the thing that I think is most important is your context, how metabolically healthy you are, how insulin sensitive you are. I don't think LDL matters that much if you are insulin sensitive, and I talk about why with Dr. Twyman in this podcast, and I get his perspective as a board-certified cardiologist, and we even hear about things like endothelial health and how to really get a sense of your cardiovascular risk way beyond what happens in a traditional cholesterol panel. All right, guys, onto the podcast with Dr. Mike Twyman. Enjoy this one. Michael Twyman, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's not uncommonly that I talk about lipids on my podcast. So it's always a pleasure and privilege to talk to cardiologists. Previously, I've had on Dr. Nadir Ali, and I think I had Jock Wolfson on in the past. So you're the third cardiologist that's come on the podcast. But tell people a little bit. I always feel like it's boring to do the intro with like who you are in the beginning, but just so people know your credentials and stuff, tell them what you do and who you are. And then I want to jump into my recent blood work and let you give people an opinion of my lipids and my cardiovascular risk.
Sure, sure. I'd love to do it. So thank you for the opportunity today to chat with your audience. So I'm Dr. Michael Twyman. I'm a board certified cardiologist. My passion is helping people prevent heart attacks. I used to be an invasive cardiologist doing many procedures on people who were sick in the hospital. But a couple of years ago, I got much more interested in preventing it than actually stenting it, as they say. So now I'm, solo practitioner in St. Louis. I have multiple non-invasive, devices in my office that tell people if they're developing endothelial dysfunction or subclinical atherosclerosis many years, if not decades, before they're going to show up in the hospital with a heart attack.
That's really cool. I definitely want to talk about those devices because I'm not aware of any good way that I could get my endothelial function checked. Maybe I'll have to come to St. Louis and we can do some content around checking my endothelial dysfunction, but that's really cool, the non-invasive stuff. And for people that don't know, I was a physician assistant before I went to medical school, and my physician assistant time was in cardiology. So I have a real love for this, this section of medicine. I really find atherosclerosis, the formation of these plaques in the arteries, very interesting. And most people listening to this will know that cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of us as humans. And we'll get into a lot of philosophical questions about that as the podcast goes on. So I'm going to start here. I have full blood work panel from July and August of 2022. I can show you the whole thing.
Sure.
So I can show you my lipids. I can show you whatever you want to see. For people that want to know all of these blood work results, I've gone over them in detail on two previous podcasts, but I'm going to share them with Dr. Twyman and let him, get a sense of what he thinks of my lipids and my cardiovascular risk, at least as best we can based on these. So just to start, these are my recent cholesterol numbers. I got an ammonia from the plasma there just because I was interested in what my ammonia would be eating protein, but I have a full panel. So anything else you want to see, I can pull up for you. I have hsCRP, I have fasting insulin, I have iron studies, I have all kinds of stuff. So I'll let you take it from here.
Sure. So this is what I do day in, day out, is help people interpret their labs and show them where their risk really lies. And I know you're pretty well steeped in the, the lipid terminology, but traditional cholesterol panels are not that useful to predict people's risk. There's really only two things I will look at in a traditional lipid panel. I'll look at their HDL cholesterol, I'll look at the triglycerides. That gives me an insight into is the likelihood of them being insulin resistant high or low. If they have really high triglycerides and really low HDL cholesterol, it's much more likely they're going to be insulin resistant. And yourself, looks like your ratio is approximately 1:1. So would not expect you to be insulin resistant or pre-diabetic. But then looking at the total cholesterol and the LDL cholesterol, they're interesting numbers, but they really don't predict risk well. They're just the passengers inside the lipoproteins, which I'm sure you've probably checked on yourself, and we'll look into that. But if somebody's total cholesterol is over 300 milligrams per deciliter, or the LDL cholesterol is over 190 milligrams per deciliter, there's a possibility that this person may have familial hyperlipidemia or a genetic reason why their cholesterols are elevated at baseline. But I know in your world, you know, there's people that have, quote, normal traditional lipid panels. They go on a carnivore diet or maybe even a high-fat keto diet, and their lipids, you know, blow up. And they're always wanting to know, like, is this healthy or not for their arteries? And we'll get into some of the ways you can actually figure that out. But the way you would know that if this was FH versus a dietary issue is that you would have had normal baseline lipid panels. You did your dietary intervention, and then you see things shooting up through the roof. But looking at your traditional panel, you know, no insulin resistance, the LDL cholesterol, yes, it's, quote, elevated, but I'd want to know what your ApoB is or your LDL particle count before I made further comment on it.
Okay, cool. So I can show you those. I will share that. So here is something that I did from, this is from July of 2022. And the first one was with Merrick Health, and this one is through Wellness FX. And so you can see my ApoB here, my LP little a, you can see the LDL size, which is lower than I've had in the past. You can see the particle number, the LDL phenotype, small LDL, let you just, whatever you want to see here, I can scroll and
sure.
show you.
Sure, I have to stop right there at the LDL particles. So this is what I talk about with patients, that it's the particles that predict risk. It's not the cholesterol. The cholesterol is just a passenger inside the lipoprotein. Those two words, lipid protein carrier. It's basically a cargo ship that your liver makes to fill it up full of some of the cholesterol, the triglycerides, which are energy for your muscles and other organs. There's going to be fat-soluble vitamins inside the lipoproteins, and then there'll be phospholipids, which are building blocks for the cells. So it's much more about those LDL particles than it is about the passengers inside of it. So your LDL particle count of 1900 some odd, is that high? Possibly, but I would want to know, you know, what are your markers of endothelial, you know, health? You know, do you have other issues with inflammation? And then I know you previously had at least a calcium score test. Maybe we can talk about those tests in a little bit. But, you know, is the particle count of, you know, 1900 high? Possibly. But if you wanted to decipher it down a little bit better, you would probably just say, what is this person's apolipoprotein B? That's really the biggest predictor of risk from a lipoprotein assessment. And your ApoB of 121, that's going to be in the, you know, the higher percentile of people. I mean, ideally, where would you like to see that number? Well, if you have no plaque in your arteries, probably closer to 80 is probably more optimal. If you have a lot of plaque in your arteries, probably less than 60. So it's still, it's, quote, elevated, but are your arteries actually complaining about that information? We wouldn't know until we kind of did some further testing or looked at things. But ApoB, for those that aren't aware of it, it's a protein that sits on the outside of your lipoprotein. So for those watching the video, I usually show people a tennis ball. The lipoprotein is a tennis ball that the cholesterol, the triglycerides all go inside. The lipoproteins are spherical. On the outside of a tennis ball, the white stripe, that's the apolipoprotein B. The apolipoprotein B is a structural protein, so it keeps it in a sphere. But the ApoB also acts like a key, so that when this is floating through the blood vessels, the receptors on the organs will bind to that ApoB protein and then download it into the cell and get out of it what it needs. So more ApoB particles floating through your blood, there's more risk that they're going to interact with endothelium, and more likely some of them will get stuck in the endothelium. It's, you know, trigger a cascade, which could build up to a fatty plaque and later a plaque.
So do you think that LDL particles are directly injurious to the endothelium?
There's a school of thought that it is, that it's the total particle count that is the biggest driver, but it's going to be tending to be multifactorial. I look at it more as, you know, your particle count is a snapshot in time, what is floating around in your blood, but it's not a video picture. Nobody knows exactly where those LDL particles are going to. You know, if you're making more LDL particles because you're delivering their payload to your muscles, and none of them are taking kind of a side detour into your artery wall, well, it's like a no harm, no foul type of situation. So it's something where I always will test people's endothelial health, you know, do other tests to look at, you know, for subclinical atherosclerosis. If they're having evidence that they're starting to lay down fatty streaks or small, soft plaques, then somehow those LDL particles were getting retained in the artery wall and dropping off their cargo there. But just looking at a particle count, you know, it's just looking at like all comers, you know, technically if people have higher particle counts, they're likely to have more plaque in their arteries, but it's not always a one-to-one ratio.
Yeah. I think this is a really important point that is hard to overstate. And so I'll comment on it a little bit from my perspective and hopefully add to that. There is an association, I think, in the literature between higher levels of ApoB particles and atherosclerosis. But the key word there is association. We're kind of back to this epidemiology rabbit hole. And I would urge the listener or watcher to remember that the majority of the population, at least in the United States, is insulin resistant. So in that situation, I think there's this interesting hypothesis that I would like you to weigh in on as a board-certified cardiologist, that is it also possible, is an alternative hypothesis that, yeah, we see an association between ApoB amount, particle number, et cetera, and atherosclerosis, because the majority of the pond is pretty murky. And in people who have insulin resistance, this is just a hypothesis, right? In people who have insulin resistance, yeah, there could be some of that ApoB going into the artery wall, and potentially the artery wall is damaged because we know that wound repair, endothelial repair is probably damaged in cases of insulin resistance. So in people who are insulin resistant, and we know that 90% of the United States population probably has at least one risk factor for metabolic syndrome, elevated ApoB may lead to more atherosclerosis. But isn't it also possible that in people who are not insulin resistant, like you said, there's more to this picture, the endothelial function may really be the determining factor here. And then people like me, perhaps, but you can disagree with me if you don't agree with this hypothesis, an elevated ApoB, quote unquote, may not actually be driving atherosclerosis, because hopefully I and many of the people that listen to this podcast don't fall into that murky water. We swim in clean water because we do these other things. But that's just an alternative hypothesis that I've sort of thought about and wanted to get your perspective on it.
Sure. And I'm well-versed in that. And I think you're, you know, speaking of kind of the lean mass hyper-responders that we, you know, sometimes see in this type of community. You know, in the traditional cardiology world, you know, the greatest majority of patients are probably going to be insulin resistant, and the ApoB is just kind of a follow along. It's like, okay, you got to treat the insulin resistance. But in people who are generally younger, healthier, good, you know, lean muscle mass, and they have this phenotype, well, that's a test, don't guess philosophy. So plaque starts in the arteries sometimes as early as your teens and 20s, but you don't have clinical events usually until you're 40, 50, 60 years old. So you have a lot of time to intervene on it. And so I look at it as, what is the first sign that somebody has an issue? It's endothelial dysfunction. So this, you know, was probably a good side point for it. So your endothelium is the inner lining of your arteries. It's one cell thick. It coats your entire lining of your arteries. And the surface area would be equivalent to 6 tennis courts. So it's one of your largest secretory organs. Sitting on top of the endothelium is something that I honestly didn't learn in my fellowship, and I don't know if you did in any of your training, was the endothelial glycocalyx. The glycocalyx is this gel coat. It's like a cotton candy consistency. Sometimes I teach my patients, it's kind of like seagrass sitting at the bottom of a riverbed, and it's just sensing what's floating through the riverbed or your blood vessels. And that sends information to the endothelium about, you know, what's floating in the blood and also the pressure that's floating through the blood. And then the endothelium, one of the major things it does is it releases nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is a signaling molecule. It's very short-lived, only a second or two, but that nitric oxide will cause the muscle and the artery wall to relax. So that improves blood flow, keeps your blood pressure down. But nitric oxide also has like Teflon or nonstick surface. Yeah, when you have high levels of nitric oxide, things don't stick to the artery walls. So those blood cells, those lipoproteins, they just zip on by. It's kind of like a maglev train. But if you have low nitric oxide levels and an ApoB particle, that ApoB might start sticking to a damaged endothelium. And then your immune system thinks basically bacteria is being, you know, an invader into the artery wall. And then the monocytes come in there and start gobbling it up. And turns into a macrophage, and then you start at the cascade into developing a fatty streak and a plaque. So the lipoproteins by themselves, you know, they're supposed to be doing a job. You know, they're delivering, you know, triglycerides to your muscles, for example. You know, the only bad lipoprotein would be the ones that got stuck to your endothelium, get retained in the artery wall, and kick off that cascade.
So I tried to pull up some graphics while you're talking, showing the glycocalyx here, like you said, this kind of seagrass on the outside. Here are the endothelial cells for people watching. And then beneath the endothelial cells is the subintimal space, right? Correct. Or this intima, mm-hmm. and subintimal space. And in the subintimal space, I can try and pull up another graphic, is where these macrophages are. So I think a lot of people don't maybe we should just dig into that for people a little bit, the way that LDL particles might move through. So in the blood circulation are these buses that house this substances, the cholesterol and the triglycerides. Cholesterol is a steroid molecule, right? And triglycerides are these three-tailed kind of fatty acid, like little jellyfish. And they're all in this lipoprotein bus, so they can be soluble in an aqueous water environment. And sometimes those particles move into the artery wall through the endothelium. But like you said, they have to move past this glycocalyx, this seagrass, and into that wall. And so there's a lot of interesting factors here. Maybe you can just talk a little more about that, like what we know might damage the endothelium, how people get endothelial function, and then what happens. You spoke about it a little bit. Let's go a little deeper. Like what happens once it gets into that endothelial wall and those macrophages, there are these immune cells that then engulf the LDL.
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, atherosclerosis, the first sign of it is endothelial dysfunction. And this can start in your teens and 20s. And, you know, you have many years to intervene before these plaques really take hold. But there's hundreds of things that can damage endothelial glycocalyx. You know, insulin resistance being one of the worst offenders, you know, having high insulin levels, high glucose is definitely going to damage it. But, you know, air pollution, high inflammatory loads from other things, you know, you have rheumatoid arthritis, you got Hashimoto's, you know, you have, you know, I hate the word leaky gut, but you got a really bad, you know, gut, you know, microbiome, and you're just, you know, having issues with your GI system can drive it. You know, the virus that's unnamed and been going around lately, those spike proteins actually yeah. damage the glycocalyx. Yeah. That's one of the major ways that virus was injuring people was it damaged the glycocalyx and then the blood would clot. So lots of things that kind of give that seagrass a haircut, but there's many things that you can help, you know, regrow it. But if one of these, you know, ApoB containing particles, you know, basically gets stuck there like Velcro, then it gets retained in that intima, that lining below the endothelium. And what I tell my patients is, you know, once it gets stuck there, it's not coming out. And it's just a matter of how bad is the immune response going to be. The white blood cells basically come in because they think, hey, you know, bacteria is attacking us. Let's see what's going on. The monocyte engulfs it, eats it essentially. And then the lipoprotein, which was supposed to be delivering, you know, triglycerides to your muscles, well, it's kind of like a Trojan horse. It's now stuck in the intima and, you know, it dies there essentially. So the cholesterol, the triglycerides, they just kind of leak out into the intimal space and it causes swelling in that territory. So that inflammation will continue unless you stop the insults. The body can eventually heal it, but if it continues on, you keep banging into a damaged endothelium with all these ApoB particles, it's going to be like a little pimple building up in your artery or a volcano. It's just a slow roll for a long time before it clinically presents with angina if you have a severe blockage or a plaque rupture and you show up with a heart attack. So the body will keep trying to take care of this process if it can, but if it doesn't, then the body will start forming these soft plaques. The soft plaques eventually may become hard plaques. The hard plaques are generally more stable. They're not necessarily going to cause heart attacks. They can cause angina if you get a severe, you know, stenosis, you know, generally greater than 70%. But it's this ongoing cascade that happens. And so, you know, I usually tell people it's kind of like subway stations. You know, the first sign is that endothelium's broken. Okay, once endothelium's broken, the intima starts swelling. You can assess that with a carotid intimal medial thickness ultrasound. If you have really thick intima, it means you have inflammation in the artery and likely some ApoB particles are getting down in there. And then the soft plaques start building.
Stunned. Immediate results. Check out this review on Whole Package from Heart and Soil Supplements. I've never, in caps, taken a supplement that I actually experienced results within a few hours. Every single time I take the 6 capsules of Whole Package, I feel more energized. I've also experienced a serious increase in my libido. Lastly, I feel that my overall muscle density has increased as I've continued to take the Whole Package supplement. I've never written a review of a supplement, but this one really has made such a difference in how I feel that I felt it was important to let others know and to spread the good word. This is what we do at Heart and Soil. We make supplements like Whole Package, which has testicle and liver and blood. They're desiccated. They're from grass-fed, regeneratively raised cattle in New Zealand. The best on the planet. It's always packaged in glass, no microplastics or phthalates or xenoestrogens here. And reviews like this come in all the time on Whole Package and all of our supplements. You can go to heartandsoil.co, that's .co, to grab some Whole Package or get some other desiccated organs into your life. Our mission at Heart and Soil is to help you reclaim your birthright to optimal health. Optimal health belongs to you. Changing your diet and lifestyle, getting organs, these are critical. And at Heart and Soil, we are proud to be able to help you do that. Get fresh organs if you can. If you can't get fresh organs, get Whole Package at heartandsoil.co. So would you agree with the statement that probably most of us, I mean, I would say all humans are having some endothelial damage. It's impossible to avoid. And one of the things that I learned in medical school and probably when I was a PA was that, hey, just being in an artery, just a high pressure vessel, 120 millimeters of mercury when the heart contracts, you know, all those arteries have muscles around them and they keep this pressure in the arteries. I mean, I can put a blood pressure cuff on the artery of my arm and I have 120 to 125 millimeters of mercury of pressure in an artery in my arm. And at the bifurcations, places where those arteries might branch like a fork in the road, that turbulence can cause the endothelium to get a little bit denuded or, you know, it could probably damage the glycocalyx. We're all exposed to a little bit of toxins. We're all going to get some heavy metals in our life. We're all going to be exposed to some air pollution, unfortunately. So we're all going to damage the endothelium to some degree. And I think that probably that means that, yeah, there's some damaged endothelium. There's going to be some fatty streaking in all of us. But does that mean that we're all going to develop atherosclerosis to a very severe degree as we age?
That's a great point, is that, you know, it's, you know, very likely everybody's going to develop some degree of atherosclerosis if you live long enough. You know, there's autopsy, you know, reports from, you know, the Vietnam War that soldiers that came back, you know, 18 years old had fatty streaks in the aorta. Like if what they were doing didn't change, they would have likely developed coronary disease later on in their 40s or 50s. So I think atherosclerosis is one of the few things that like is inevitable. Everybody's going to probably develop a certain amount of it, but not everybody has to go on to actually have clinical events. They don't need to have heart attacks, strokes, get stented, get bypass surgery. So it's just first going looking for it. You know, there's certain people that have certain genetic preloads. You know, I noticed on your labs, you do not have lipoprotein A. Maybe we can do a side note on that later, but you know, if you don't have plaque in your arteries at an early age, that's great. But if you're 60, 70, 80 years old, it's very likely you're going to have some plaque. But does that mean you have to, you know, have an event? No. If you keep your endothelial function generally relatively stable, you keep your inflammation load stable, you don't become insulin resistant, those plaques, your body is able to kind of handle them. It's the kind of, I call like the red hot plaques, the ones that are like volcanoes ready to blow. Those are the ones that you really are worried about.
I mean, the way I think about it, and I correct me if you think this metaphor needs more detail or is completely off base, is that we're all kind of like new cars, you know, and you buy this new car. I bought a truck here in Costa Rica and you get it from the factory. Everybody's bought a new car and you're like, wow, that's great. And every new car is going to get some scratches on it over the course of its life. And the longer you own that car, you're going to get scratches. And this is probably where the metaphor breaks down a little bit, just like we all, you know, let's just move the metaphor laterally to all of us. Like I've got some scars on my body, just like my car has a few scars. I've got a scar on the back of my leg where I had a surgery in medical school because I actually got an infection there. I had a ganglion cyst that got infected. It's a whole crazy story about an orthopedist who injected it with steroids when he shouldn't have. It got infected. I had an abscess. So I have a scar on the back of my knee. So as we're going through life as humans, we're all getting these little scars. And you know, you remember kids, they fall, they skin their knee. I've got scars on my knees from when I was a kid. I've got scars on my hands from mountain biking as a kid. So I wonder if it's accurate to portray the inside of our arteries, kind of like my knees and ankles and wrists are like this new car. Like it's going to get some scratches, but over the time, like just because I got a scar on my knuckle here from mountain biking. And I remember exactly when this happened. I think I was in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I was going down a trail and I just ran the mountain bike right into a rock and I've got a scar right on my knuckle, right? But my body kind of repaired that scar. And so do you think it's accurate to make this analogy, this metaphor between this comparison between the inside of our arteries, probably going to have some fatty streaks at certain times in our lives, but whether or not those become really big lesions and problematic is how we take care of the vehicle, how we take care of our bodies, you know, just because I'm not constantly running into this rock with my hand. You know, this is not getting infected. It's pretty healed and my body's gone on. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a reasonable sort of way for people to think about it?
I think so. I mean, you know, you're right. You know, we're born, you know, to be optimized and it's through epigenetics that things start breaking down over time. You know, I frequently talk about with patients that, you know, I'm going towards more of a mitochondrial focus in my care that, you know, the things that take care of your mitochondria take care of you. So your brain, your heart, your skeletal muscle, those are the organs with the most mitochondria. And when you're born, you know, those are your battery packs. And then how you live your life determines how those battery packs break down over time. You know, they get 10% less effective at making energy as you age every decade. And so that's why most chronic diseases don't show up to your 40, 50, 60, because you're able to make enough energy to repair the damage. I mean, you know, a kid who falls down, they have amazing wound healing. You know, if you're a 60-year-old and get a skin tear, you know, it maybe take weeks before it, you know, looks normal. So I think it's kind of a wear and tear philosophy is something that you can think about, but there's so many things you can do to, you know, not only get the insults out of your system, but just to how you optimize your mitochondrial function.
And then optimize the repair.
Right.
We kind of hinted at this earlier. One of the things that I think a lot of people may not understand is that insulin resistance, essentially pre-diabetes leading to diabetes, it's all on a continuum. This really results in immune compromise and impaired wound repair. And perhaps you could make an argument that the most important wounds we could ever repair are the times that we skin the knee, quote unquote, in our arteries, on the endothelium of our arteries. And so no surprise, diabetics, even pre-diabetics, show up with increased rates of atherosclerosis. And, you know, there was a physician, I forget his first name, his name was Kraft, and he developed this Kraft assay for type 1 diabetes. And I think he had this famous quote that even people who came into the hospital with cardiac events, when he did oral glucose tolerance testing on them and they were undiagnosed, as they were not diagnosed with diabetes, invariably they had insulin resistance. They had impaired insulin sensitivity when they were tested. I thought that was such a profound statement. I wish Western medicine had gone down that rabbit hole further, because that is something that I believe is probably true. That, and people would debate this, but this is where I differ with a lot of mainstream physicians in the cardiology space. I don't think that clinically meaningful atherosclerosis, except for maybe a few genetic conditions, we can talk about those, you know, familial, you know,
familial hyperlipidemia,
FH or Dunnigan lipodystrophy, you know, but those people are insulin resistant by default anyway. So I don't think a lot of cardiovascular disease, I don't think there's a significant amount of cardiovascular disease that's clinically meaningful for humans that happens independent of insulin resistance. And that insulin resistance may just not be diagnosed. Any thoughts about that?
No, I definitely think insulin resistance is underdiagnosed. I mean, yeah, if you're only checking, you know, hemoglobin A1C and a glucose, you're going to be missing a lot of people. You know, the advent of the continuous glucose monitor is amazing. You know, I know a lot of the biohackers use them to kind of titrate in their glucose loads. You really don't know unless you test certain things. You know, if you're testing your body only at, you know, static state, you don't know what your pancreas is going to do when you put in a big load. I mean, I personally have never done an OGTT on myself. I just haven't wanted to sit through it. But I've done some of the CGMs and, you know, would try to eat certain foods and see like what would actually break my glucose. And so I think that is something that if you go looking for it, you're going to find a lot of people who are insulin resistant. But as you know, like one of my good friends, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, that always talks about insulin resistance, you know, generally starts in your skeletal muscle. You know, 80% of your glucose is getting disposed of in your skeletal muscle. So that's the big kind of pandemic, is that, you know, people don't move enough, they don't eat enough protein to stimulate their muscles, and then they become insulin resistant, and then it just continues to cascade, and the arteries are kind of going to be the innocent bystanders getting damaged, you know, long term.
I did a podcast recently that people can find. It's called Meat Versus Plants for Longevity. And the argument I made in that podcast was that sarcopenia kills far, far more people. I don't believe red meat kills anyone, but I think sarcopenia is way worse for longevity than anyone can make an argument that red meat is bad for longevity. I don't think red meat is bad for longevity at all, but this longevity community, in quotes, with a little bit of an eye roll, a respectful eye roll, you know, they would say limit leucine, limit methionine. And I'm thinking those are the amino acids you need to do muscle protein synthesis. And I love Gabrielle and Don Lehman and the work they've done. And, you know, I've cited a paper by Don Lehman in that podcast and said, hey, look, we need 110 milligrams of leucine per day per kilogram. 165-pound human like me needs 8 grams of leucine per day. You can get that in 8 ounces of ground beef or 8 cups of cooked lentils. Which do you want? And that 8 cups of cooked lentils is probably not going to be that bioavailable for the leucine. So I agree with you. Having muscle mass, avoiding sarcopenia, that's the way to have longevity and to remain insulin resistant. I want to circle back to what we were saying about everyone developing atherosclerosis, because I liked what you said, that if people maintain the health of their endothelium, this may not be a problem that you're developing a little bit of a fatty streak. We're probably all going to skin our knees at some point in our life. But there are people in the lipid community, there are prominent physicians who will remain nameless, but I'm sure most people will know who I'm talking about, who say now, who have now begun saying on their podcasts, everyone develops atherosclerosis. Even, you know, kids going to Vietnam who are obviously eating garbage foods and super stressed, had fatty streaks. So he's essentially saying that we should all lower our serum LDL to 30 to 40 milligrams per deciliter. And I'm not sure what level of ApoB he would equate that to, 50, you know, certainly below 60. And I think that's lunacy. Like, I just don't think that that's reasonable, that we should really try and short circuit hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution and say, hey, look, we're just broken human organisms. This argument doesn't make any sense to me. He's essentially saying everyone should be on a statin or a PCSK9 inhibitor to get you're never going to get your LDL that low or your ApoB that low through diet alone. He said this, but I'm thinking, man, where did you go off the deep end here? This is a little bit bonkers. Do you think that everyone needs a PCSK9 inhibitor? Everybody needs a statin. Everybody should have their ApoB at 50 or their LDL at 30 to 40 milligrams per deciliter, like we did when we were born, and then we can avoid all fatty streaks in our whole lives.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a reductionist thinking that, you know, we got to have, you know, what we were born with. But it is one of those things where, you know, I treat the individual sitting in front of me. I'm not doing population-based medicine. You know, if you take all comers with, you know, an ApoB of 180, well, a good chunk of them are going to have, you know, plaque in their left anterior descending, and some of them won't. Yeah, which ones won't? Well, you got to know who, you know, is likely not to. They don't have inflammation. They don't have insulin resistance. They make nitric oxide on demand. You know, they have healthy endothelial glycocalyx. Those LDL particles are just zipping on by, you know, call it like a maglev train. You know, the glycocalyx is negatively charged. The outside of your red blood cells and the lipoproteins are negatively charged. Negative repels negative. So I don't think it's useful to say that like statins or PCSK9 should be in the water and everybody needs to be this way. But I also don't think, like some people think that like they're absolute poisons and nobody should be on them. You know, you've treated people in the hospital who had heart attacks, have had their chest cracked open with multivessel bypass. You're just trying to prevent, you know, the second event. You know, you're throwing the kitchen sink at these individuals just to try to put out the fires. You know, those individuals will do better on those type of therapies. But a younger person who's never had an event, you know, you have to kind of individualize it to that person. And in my, you know, world, you know, I'm looking at tests that look at endothelial function. There's a test called Max Pulse. It looks like a pulse oximeter. It sits on your finger. It's about a 1-minute test. And it looks at the elasticity of your arteries. Healthy arteries are very elastic. They, you know, contract and expand like an accordion very quickly. If the artery is sick, it's going to be like a lead pipe and that flow is going through very rapidly. So if you have an abnormal max pulse or pulse wave velocity, you probably have some evidence of endothelial dysfunction. I have a device called the EndoPat that is basically like a stress test for the arteries. It's a test that you administer for over about 15-minute period. 5 minutes of it is an occlusion of your brachial artery. So you have a blood pressure cuff on and you pump it up higher than your systolic blood pressure. You'll get like a pins and needles sensation as you kind of cut off the flow to their hand for a minute. Yeah, it's kind of a weird sensation. But after 5 minutes, you crank open the blood pressure cuff, blood rushes back down into the hand. And if you have healthy endothelial glycocalyx and a healthy endothelium, that huge slug of blood is registered as, oh, here it comes. The body will pump out nitric oxide to cause the smooth muscle in the artery to relax, and then the flow improves. So this test will give you a percentage of how much can your arteries dilate when there's a vessel stressor. They should at least double in size, but ideally triple or quadruple in size. So if your level's less than 2, you got some work to do. If your level's 3 or 4, you know, probably not going to be developing a lot of plaque right now. Even if you had plaque in your arteries from before, you're probably not doing it right now. So I always tell people, like, just because you had a stent or bypass doesn't mean you got to have a second or third one if you can repair the endothelial health. So always start there. And then doing the things like you did, the biomarkers, you know, how much inflammation's in your system. You know, if it's due to insulin resistance, work on that. But if it's, you know, bad gut health or thyroid disease or, you know, something else, you don't sleep well, you know, you get too much junk blue light, whatever it is, work on that root cause to lower the inflammation. You get the inflammation down and have healthy nitric oxide levels, those lipoproteins aren't going to continue to be deposited in the artery wall then.
Yeah, I think this is such an important point that I don't think, we certainly weren't taught this. I wasn't taught this in medical school, that occasionally there's a mention, oh, people with rheumatoid arthritis do actually seem to have elevated rates of cardiovascular disease. We don't really understand it, but you know, we know that people with diabetes do, but this is one of the reasons that I began my own personal journey. I had eczema and asthma, and my eczema wasn't always horrible, but this is an autoimmune condition. And I'm thinking, I don't want low-grade chronic inflammation in my dermis, in any part of my body. If there's a food, which was my hypothesis, or something in my environment that's triggering this autoimmune condition in my skin, and people may know there are lots of autoimmune conditions, skin conditions, lupus, rheumatoid, type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, psoriasis, et cetera. I wanted to try and correct that. So that was how I got interested in dietary modification for autoimmune disease. First, it led me to a carnivore diet. Then I sort of expanded my perspective a little bit. Now I have fruit and honey and raw dairy, trying to mimic an ancestral diet as best I can. And that's what I generally like to think about for people. And I think that elimination diets and dietary attention can be so powerful for autoimmune disease. But how interesting, and I've talked about this on other podcasts. I did a podcast a few weeks ago with Tucker Goodrich and Jeff Knobs talking about seed oils. And I want to get your perspective on these as well. And one of the things that came up was that, these seed oils are inflammatory and that they do make LDL more likely to oxidize. And there's all sorts of issues. So there's a real connection between dietary things and inflammation and heart stuff. And when you get these out of your diet, it can really change the way your arteries are in terms of their health. So it's so interesting to think about like how these seemingly disparate things, I have psoriasis. Well, maybe the psoriasis could actually be creating endothelial dysfunction and that could worsen your risk of cardiovascular disease. So fixing humans at a basic root cause level, I think, is what we should be about in medicine. And I'm, eternally frustrated. And this is one of the reasons that I do what I do now rather than what I was probably going to do in the past is I try to do broader education because Western medicine is so siloed. When I was a PA, the cardiologist would literally mime a box around the heart and say, treat this. Don't treat the thyroid. Don't treat somebody's diabetes. Don't treat their rheumatoid. That's not your job. I was thinking, man, these doctors are just so siloed in the way that we think about all these things. Do you run into that in your practice? I would imagine that you think about things more holistically. Is it difficult for you to see someone with those things? Or do you think holistic? I imagine you think more holistically when you give a patient a treatment plan.
Correct. Yeah. I don't always know what to describe myself as. A preventive cardiologist, I'll use that one, but I like the word integrative because I use the best of the Western medicine that I got trained in. I'm still board certified, just recertified in echocardiography and cardiovascular disease. So I still know what all the Western trained medicine guys know, but then went down the functional medicine rabbit hole for many years. And that's a good starting point, cleaning up their diet, getting out the toxins. But if functional medicine was the answer, everybody would be cured. We'd all be doing functional medicine. So, there's still something people are missing. And so now I kind of add a little bit more into the biohacking scene, getting your circadian rhythm optimized. How do you optimize your mitochondria? There's a whole field of quantum biology, quantum medicine. So, how do you make energy in your cells with the right light environments? All those things that are beneficial. So I do a more holistic approach, so I'm not just focused on the heart. I got 60,000 miles of blood vessels. If you have problems in your heart arteries, you probably have problems in your penis, your brain, the places that other people care about. So you start looking, you'll find those things. But no, I manage some thyroid diseases, insulin resistance, those directly impact what's going on with the cardiovascular system.
So just so we give people this complete picture, you talked about the max pulse, kind of like the pulse oximeter that goes on your finger. Is that something somebody could just buy for themselves or is it very expensive?
You can potentially buy it yourself. I don't remember. I think it's like $6,000 for the unit or something like that. So most people aren't going to buy it for themselves, but I basically, every single patient that comes to my office, I screen them every time. I do the regular pulse ox, I do the max pulse. I check their blood pressure, but I have a fancy blood pressure device that not only checks your brachial blood pressure, but will also estimate your central aortic blood pressure because that's the blood pressure as the blood is being driven down your coronary arteries up to your brain. You earlier talked about kind of like shear stress when you have a bifurcation. What's that increased shear stress that damages that glycocalyx? It basically gives it that haircut. So you can measure, well, what is the pressure going down your coronary arteries? Because that's what you're really concerned about. So yes, there are some of these things that, are going to be a little pricey that, probably you're going to have to go to a doctor or a clinic that has these type of things. But, the quote free things, well, you should have a normal resting blood pressure. And what I consider normal, probably 110 over 70 without medications. Now, the guidelines are going to say like, start treating with meds if you're over 140 over 90. Yes and no. If depends on their stroke risk and other, you know, factors and stuff. But yeah, I usually sometimes joke that, you know, hypertension really isn't a disease. It's, you know, it's an ICD-10 code. It's, you know, what's utilized to get reimbursement from insurance companies. You know, hypertension is something wrong in your environment that you're missing. There's something in your nutrition, you aren't doing the right proper exercise, or you have a high inflammatory load from something else, or you, in our world, don't sleep well, you know, you're high stress. There's something in your environment that's breaking your body's ability to make nitric oxide efficiently.
Yeah. And we've talked about nitric oxide. So I want to make sure people understand what we're talking about here. This is a compound, NO, yeah, is nitric oxide. And it's critical for the health of your arteries, right? There are inducible enzymes. There's inducible nitric oxide synthase, and there's endothelial nitric oxide synthase that make nitric oxide, correct me if I'm wrong, from amino acids, right? Things like arginine or other amino acids. And like you mentioned earlier, when your arteries, when your blood vessels, probably the veins too, need this nitric oxide to do this contraction, well, this dilatation, and that gives you some sense of the health, and that a healthy amount of nitric oxide production is a good thing.
Exactly right. And yeah, sometimes on the podcast, people are like, what about times when there's really high nitric oxide? Well, that's more when you're talking about the iNOS type of stuff. And you know, your body produces different levels of nitric oxide in different tissues. So your immune system is going to use nitric oxide to go kill bacteria and viruses. Not necessarily talking about that. I'm talking about the, you know, ones that are in your blood vessels. So there's two major pathways that your body will make nitric oxide. There's the one that your body's going to convert arginine into citrulline, and that's going to be using that eNOS enzyme. But after the age of 40 or so, that enzyme becomes less effective at making that conversion happen. So in a lot of the bodybuilding world, you know, they're pumping a lot of arginine into the system. They're not really deficient in that amino acid. They just don't have a very well-functioning eNOS enzyme. So there's a backup pathway where nitrates that you get in through your diet, so typically that's going to be, you know, the green leafy vegetables for the most part. If you have nitrate-reducing bacteria in your saliva, that will break that down into nitrites. You swallow that, it goes into your stomach. And then if you have stomach acid, then you can make the enzymes that will make eNOS, and you'll make nitric oxide from that nitrite. That will also eventually try to help your body's endogenous approach, you know, that L-arginine converting to citrulline. It'll try to work on that enzyme as well. But if you're on, you know, a proton pump inhibitor, you know, don't have any stomach acid, you're not going to break down protein well, you're not going to have enzymes in your stomach well. If you're, you know, slamming antiseptic mouthwash all the time, or you're drinking a lot of water with fluoride in it, you're disrupting the biome, you know, the nitrate reducing bacteria in your saliva. So, you know, there's so many things you can do to like remove. It's, you know, it's addition through subtraction, and then the body's levels of nitric oxide can start kicking back up.
So it's interesting. I found a couple of articles. I don't know if you've seen this. Raw honey also increases nitric oxide levels and has nitric oxide derivatives in people. So we see this. But what the researchers mentioned, and I can pull up the study if you want, was that the darker the honey it is, the better. If the honey's been heated, it's a problem. If the honey's been exposed to light, it's a problem. So, you know, I just did a podcast with Ken Berry, and we were talking about the pros and cons of honey. He's kind of a low-carb keto guy, but he's open-minded. And I was saying, hey, look, honey, there's good evidence that real raw honey, preferably organic, preferably not, you know, from somewhere where they have glyphosate, especially a dark honey, that can increase your nitric oxide as well. And conversely, I'm happy to pull up both of these studies for people if they want to see this. I've spoken about them in the past. There's a really interesting study done in Sweden. I would love to see this repeated, where they gave people a high saturated fat diet as a lead-in. And then they gave them, they either continued that diet or they gave them seed oils. They gave them polyunsaturated fatty acids. And when they did a saturated fat lead-in, and we can talk about why that's interesting, and then they gave them seed oils, they saw all sorts of problems happen. There was increased oxidative stress markers, and there were decreased markers of nitric oxide metabolism. So I thought that was really interesting, that on the one hand, you have dietary sources of nitrite or nitrate if your endothelial nitric oxide synthase is not working well. And there's a whole discussion about why that might, you know, decline as we age, or if it does decline as we age in somebody that's doing other things properly. And then there's these things that can impair nitric oxide production in the human body. Of course, I think heavy metals can probably do it. Anything that's going to damage the glycocalyx. But there's an interventional study with seed oils showing that it's going to impair this. I thought that was so interesting. I wanted to just insert something here that I didn't get a chance to talk about with Michael in this podcast. I wanted to talk about this study. I had it pulled up, but we didn't get to talk about it. But I thought it's really interesting. So Michael mentions that nitrates, precursors of nitric oxide, are found in leafy green vegetables. This is true. I'm not a huge fan of leafy green vegetables, so it got me thinking, where else can you get nitric oxide derivatives? I talked about honey in this podcast, but I also wanted to share this study, which I was thinking of, didn't get a chance to share during the podcast, looking at red orange juice. So some fruit has biologically active amounts of nitric oxide. The effects of red orange juice intake on endothelial function and inflammatory markers in adult subjects with increased cardiovascular risk. And if you look at this, 7-day consumption of red orange juice improved endothelial function, reduced inflammation in non-diabetic subjects with increased cardiovascular risk. So just like Mike is talking about in this podcast, protecting your endothelium is critical, but how cool that there are compounds found in fruit and some vegetables. We can talk about the plus minus of those in a separate podcast, and honey that can be contributors in a positive way to nitric oxide with regard to the vasculature. So I just wanted to share this study at this point in the podcast, and then we'll get back to the conversation I had with Mike.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and we'll get into the fat, you know, discussion in just a second, I think. But, you know, you'd mentioned, you know, glyphosate. You know, that's ubiquitous in most people's diets. And that glyphosate replaces glycine, you know, one of the amino acids that the endothelial glycocalyx is right. going to utilize. If you poison the glycocalyx with glyphosate, you'll ultimately poison the ENOS enzyme and make less nitric oxide. So it's maybe not always the food you're eating. It's what's sprayed on your foods is the problem.
Yeah, I love that. And I want to talk about seed oils next. I'll just comment that, you know, sometimes people will say organic food is a scam. It's the same amount of nutrients as non-organic food. And I think, do you know, like there's bonus things, bonus being a bad thing in this situation, bad bonus things that can happen with non-organic food. And I think we're just beginning to understand how bad the pesticides are. I did a podcast on glyphosate and other pesticides previously. If people want to listen to that, it was just a few months ago. But what I found in that podcast was that when the glyphosate is sprayed on crops, it's sprayed in sort of a medium, and that medium that holds the glyphosate also looks to be harmful. And then glyphosate in combination with other pesticides looks to be worse than just glyphosate alone. So I definitely think that protecting yourself and your family from as many pesticides as you can, obviously you can't avoid all toxins, is a good thing. And that kind of overlaps into the meat discussion. Mm-hmm. People will say, oh, this grain-fed beef is the same amount of nutrients as a grass-fed beef. And I think, well, first of all, it's not completely true. And second of all, the grass-fed beef, if it's from a good farm, is much less likely to have glyphosate sprayed on the grains, mold toxins in the grains, and contaminants in the meat. So it's also, I think I would encourage people to think about what you're getting in these foods, but also what you're not getting, what you might be avoiding by, you know, using some of your finances, which are precious for many people, for all of us. To protect yourself in a little better way.
Right. And then getting on to your question about the seed oils. I mean, I routinely will check, you know, with these advanced lipid companies, there's, you know, these fatty acid balance profiles where you can see how much saturated fat is being absorbed, how much trans fat, how much omega-6, how much omega-3 in the percentages, how much MUFA. And then I will just show the person like, okay, in your current diet, this is what your body is sensing. And, you know, for the most part, I'm looking for an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, approximately 4 or less. Most people, you know, before they start eating omega-3s, they sometimes have ratios 15 to 1, 20 to 1. And that's very pro-inflammatory when you have that much omega-6s floating around in your system. So, you know, I'm not, you know, a zero seed oil type person. I mean, you know, if you eat out ever, you're going to be exposed to them, but it's more about balance. And I think it's more about, you know, evolutionary, you would have never been exposed to those super high levels of omega-6s in a concentrated liquid form. And then when anytime you process something and man-made, you know, quality control is what it is, you know, if Mother Nature didn't touch it, you don't know exactly what it's going to do once you put it into the body. And I think that's where some of the issues come from, these really highly processed oils, is the, you know, the other contaminants and, you know, deuterium, if you want to go down that rabbit hole. But that's really the concern, is I think a lot of people are just way low on their omega-3s. They need to first boost that up and then see where the ratios are at.
Have you seen the video on YouTube about how canola oil is made? I think I played part of it on the podcast with Tucker and Jeff. It's crazy. I'm not going to play it again on this podcast, but you can just Google, you can just search on YouTube how canola oil is made. Basically, they start with a seed. It's a rape seed, which is something that humans would never have eaten. The rape seeds are all kind of genetically modified because a wild type rape seed is so high in this fatty acid called erucic acid, which has been associated with Keshan's disease. It's a cardiomyopathy, I believe, but they can't even feed it to humans. Like, you can't even eat a wild rapeseed. So there's this special breed of canola that's low erucic acid. And canola is actually Canadian oil, low acid. The LA is low acid. It's an acronym, Canadian Oil Low Acid. The low acid is erucic acid, which is toxic. So you start with this seed that humans were never intended to eat, and you mill it, and you make this like canola cake, and then the canola cake gets heated, and then the canola cake, you know, they squeeze all the oils out, and then they have to wash the oils with a hexane. So this, you know, this organic chemical, which is a neurological toxin, they have to wash. All canola oil has been washed with hexane, right? And there's going to be residual hexane in the oil. Then it has to be bleached and deodorized, which means heated. And you're heating a very unstable polyunsaturated fat. I'm not making this up. And then it gets heated again to remove the waxes. And there's this scene in the video, and it just looks gross. It's just this waxy stuff coming off the oil that humans are eating. And they say, don't worry, they use the wax for vegetable shortening. And then they finally get this oil, and it's packaged into a plastic container, which is clear. And so, and it, they make it look like it's just clean and it's plastic, but you know, the plastic is going to leach into the oil. Certainly the oil is oxidized, and there's a whole bunch of literature when they've done the post hoc analysis, or when they've done these store shelf analyses of the peroxide values in these oils and the trans fats, they find 3.6 to 4.2% of that canola oil is trans fat. So it's just, it's way higher than they're reporting in these oils. It's just, it's a crazy thing the way these seed oils are made. And it's just a scary thing. I don't know why anyone would put those in their diet. And just to get this in there, I'm rambling, I apologize. When people go to dinners, you mentioned you're going to be, it's hard to avoid seed oils. I would just encourage people, be the weirdo at the table, because I am. I'm going to Austin and I'm going to ask every restaurant that I go to. I don't go to a lot of restaurants. Like, do you cook? What oil do you cook in? And then if they cook in canola, say, don't eat that food, or just, I guess if you have to eat it, you know, it's going to be cooked in a problematic oil, whether it's soybean or, you know, canola or whatever oil. But if you're getting meat, when I go to restaurants, I just get a steak or a burger and I say, what do you put on the grill? And if they say soybean or canola, I don't eat it. Like, can you just cook it on a butter. Blank grill with nothing on it? Or yeah, can you put it on a butter grill? That's amazing coming from a cardiologist, because butter is going to raise your ApoB, right? So, but that's what I do in restaurants. Let's talk. So do you recommend your patients to avoid, is that something you're counseling your patients about these days?
That's what I mean. I'm checking those, you know, fatty acid balance profiles, and then I'll show it to them. You know, most people are not necessarily, you know, using margarine anymore, but, you know, they're surprised by how much, you know, omega sixes that they are getting. And I just be like, you have to read labels, or when you're reading out, you know, be that weirdo and ask the questions, you know. Or at least start to try to supplement more with actually eating seafood so you can balance some of it out. It's not necessarily that the omega-6s are always bad. It's just that when they're in such high concentrations. But yeah, if it's highly processed and you're bringing on all the other contaminants, then your body's got to handle that as well.
Have you seen the large body of literature, or at least the body of literature regarding these oils and oxidation in LDL particles and atherosclerosis and plaques? It's quite interesting. I'll pull up a study here just so people can see what I'm talking about. But let me see here. Let's try this one.
Yeah. And while you're doing that, I mean, it's, you know, the outer, you know, the outside membranes of your cells, you know, there's going to be cholesterol, there's going to be these different fatty acids. You know, when you have a ton of these omega-6s, you know, your cell membranes are going to be much more stiff. You know, they're not going to pass information around as well. And so that's one of the issues, is just, you know, the cell-to-cell communication.
And it looks like, I mean, it looks like increasing... So we know this. We know that if you eat more linoleic acid in seed oils, or unfortunately the fat of chicken and pork that's been fed corn and soy, but I think most people are not eating an exclusively bacon diet, but you could get a moderate amount of linoleic acid if all you ate was bacon and you ate all the bacon fat, because the bacon is fed corn and soy. But if you eat more linoleic acid, most people are getting most of their linoleic acid, this omega-6 18-carbon polyunsaturated fatty acid, from seed oils, corn, canola, sunflower, safflower, soybean, et cetera. Then there's more linoleic acid in the cells of your body, and there's more linoleic acid in your LDL. And then we know from studies like this one that, hey, in people who have atherosclerosis, there's a lot more propensity for those lesions to have high levels of oxidation, or the LDL to oxidize, when the LDL particles are enriched in linoleic acid. And I think, okay, I mean, is it just that, I mean, I guess I don't understand how more cardiologists are not talking about this.
I think they're just head down taking care of people having heart attacks. And, you know, it's just like, okay, here's your stent, your aspirin, your Plavix, your statin. Next patient, please. So that's why I don't always fault them. It's just that, like, they just do not have the time to dig into a lot of this research sometimes. But this is just so important that, you know, you know, we got back to, you know, the cholesterol, you know, story. It's really when it's these ApoB particles, when they're getting oxidized, and there's labs you can check. You can check an oxidized LDL level. There's a new company, or I should say a company that has a lab called Oxidized Phospholipid on ApoB, which is even a better metric of how bad this oxidation process is happening. If your level is, you know, 7.5 on this oxidized phospholipid ApoB, you're at very high risk of having events. So, you know, not all cholesterol is created equal, or I should say cholesterol particles are created equal. If you're oxidizing, I tell people that you're like, they've been rusted. You know, your body sees this stuff as foreign now, and it has to mount an immune response to this oxidized foreign invader.
Are you familiar with the work of Brown and Goldstein? This was so interesting for me. These guys won the Nobel Prize in 1985 for the LDL receptor discovery. And apparently they did some experiments, probably cell culture, where they incubated macrophages with LDL particles. And the macrophages didn't engulf, right? The macrophages don't eat native LDL. They only eat oxidized LDL, probably because either ApoB is modified, you know, on the surface, but the scavenger receptor on those macrophages isn't really activated. It doesn't bind to the LDL particle unless they're oxidized. Am I getting that right?
I believe so. I don't know their exact work, but yeah, the company that does this lab is called Boston Heart. And yeah, that's their data, is that, you know, it's the oxidized moieties that, you know, the macrophages that are going to go in there and gobble that stuff up.
And I just showed a study as we were talking before. It was that polyunsaturated fatty acids and their breakdown products, things I've talked about on previous podcasts, these HNE and other breakdown products, do seem to stimulate the CD36 receptor on macrophages. That's part of this sort of, you know, scavenger receptor, right? Or something having to do with that engulfing of the oxidized LDL, isn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me that I think that's so fascinating. And then I found another paper. I want to ask you about LPPLA2, and then we can maybe get into Lp(a).
Sure.
I found a paper saying that soybean oil elevated LPPLA2. And I've heard varying things about LPPLA2. Maybe you can tell me what you think about that marker as a metric of risk.
Sure. So LPPLA2, or it's also sometimes known as the plaque test, PLAC, it's an enzyme that when elevated will indicate that there's essentially inflammation in the intimal lining of the artery wall. So if it's no treatment for your lipids, if your level is elevated, you have a doubling or so of your risk of having a cardiovascular event. You know, you're going to have a plaque rupture, heart attack, stroke. But once you're on treatment, there's really no great data that you should be serially following the LPPLA2, except for maybe the instance on LPLA, which we'll talk about. But I look at it as that, you know, when LPPLA2 is elevated in a person getting the test for the first time, not on treatment, it's just a red flag. You know, what is this person consuming? You know, what is their exercise? How do they sleep, stress? It's just a marker that, hey, their artery might be on fire. So often I'll do a, you know, CIMT scan and ultrasound to look at the intima. Is it swollen? And then, you know, may lead into, depending on other risk factors, getting calcium score test or CT angiograms.
Yeah, I want to pull this up. I found this study interesting. So it sounds like you believe it does have some clinical utility, and a finding like this might be sort of something to pay attention to. This is impact of an 8-week linoleic acid intake in soy oil on LPPLA2 in active, healthy activity in healthy adults. And the conclusion, an increase in plasma linoleic acid following intake of soy oil was independently associated with LPPLA2 activity, which was also related to ApoB, OxLDL, and CEPICT, which is, I believe, is a measure of endothelial function, this collagen epinephrine closure time. Are you familiar with that one?
I haven't seen that one before, but I'll look it up.
Yeah. But I thought that was so interesting. I mean, I don't know, but I'll just say there, I mean, do you think there's some discordance here? Because wouldn't most mainstream cardiologists recommend soybean oil because it lowers LDL?
Honestly, I don't know what they recommend. I mean, I don't really follow a lot of the AHA guidelines. I mean, they're usually 10, 20 years behind, and I'm trying to look forward. But, you know, I think it sometimes gets in the weeds where people really get concerned about this stuff is, you know, focus on a whole food diet. Like, you know, what would your great-grandparents have had access to? If they were eating this stuff, you're probably evolved to be able to eat this. And sometimes people overthink it. You know, if it's highly processed, it's probably not that good for you. And there's some people that are going to be Superman. They can, you know, be a garbage disposal and they can eat anything and nothing bad's going to happen to them. But the majority of people can't do that. So I would agree with you. Like, I would not be trying to hammer a ton of soybean oil. I wouldn't do it to true. Also, the thing about it you mentioned is like the lower LDL, like, is that clinically useful? Does it lower ApoB? Does it improve endothelial function? That'd be interesting. But if it doesn't do those things, I don't really care what it does to LDL cholesterol.
Yeah, I find it so interesting. And then we'll get into Lp(a) because my experience is that most cardiologists that I've talked to, that I've heard speak, either on podcasts about lipids, you know, want LDL, they want ApoB to be as low as possible. And one way to do that is to ingest seed oils. And one way to raise ApoB a little bit or moderately is to eat saturated fat and to not eat seed oils. I mean, there's a clear pattern that I've seen in myself and countless people that I've worked with and countless people who have sent me their labs that the less polyunsaturated fatty acids you eat, and this may have to do with the homeoviscous model or this membrane fluidity or the LDL receptor, the less polyunsaturated fatty acids you eat, especially the omega-6s like linoleic acid, and the more of the saturated fats that you eat, I'm getting saturated fat from animal fat. So tallow, butter, ghee, animal fat in my burgers and my steaks, the LDL goes up. Now, it doesn't go up massively. I'm eating fruit now. I definitely want to talk about Dave Feldman's stuff a little bit. When I'm not in ketosis, which I'm not in much anymore because I'm eating fruit and honey as carbohydrates, I do think my LDL is lower. And I've seen that. It's 160 to 170 milligrams per deciliter. We saw my ApoB was 121, I believe, earlier. But so I think that if I'm pretty sure I could lower my ApoB by eating some canola oil and eating less butter. But it would be so interesting. And I don't really want to do this experiment, but I think the experiment should be done where that's happening and people are actually looking at some of these metrics like you're talking about of endothelial function, looking at LPPLA2, looking at Lp(a), which we know goes up when people eat more seed oils, looking at oxidized LDL, which we know goes up when people eat more seed oils, and looking at, you know, is brachial artery reactivity, whatever metric we want to look at here, and saying, maybe we're missing the forest for the trees here, guys. Like this is why the mainstream discussion of LDL kind of grinds my gears a little bit. You want to tell us about Lp(a) because this one's pretty important, I think.
It's very important. And it's something that, unfortunately, I also didn't learn about in my traditional training. So Lp(a), it's a lipoprotein. It's basically an LDL particle that has an extra protein stuck on the outside of it. I tell patients it kind of looks like a corkscrew. It's got this weird name. It's called Kringles. You know, the longer your Kringles, the less of them you make. The shorter the Kringles, the more of these Lpa proteins you're probably making. So Lpa is made in your liver, or lipoprotein(a). 20% of the population, or up to 20% of the population, has lipoprotein(a) that's elevated. And it depends on which lab you're doing, but most of the time the cutoff is 75 milligrams per deciliter. Lipoprotein(a) is the number one genetically inherited lipoprotein that increases the risk of early cardiovascular disease. So Bob Harper, the guy from The Biggest Loser, had a heart attack in the gym, looked super fit on the outside. He had very high levels of lipoprotein(a). And it's one of those things that's not going to get picked up on your traditional cholesterol panel. Quick side note is, you know, if you're, quote, eating healthy and exercising and you still have a high LDL-C and you don't have access to the particle count, well, part of that LDL-C is going to be miscalculating it as Lpa. It's going to, and you're not going to be able to do anything from a nutrition standpoint to be lowering that LDL-C at that point. So you have to actually measure the lipoprotein A. It's not a very expensive test. I believe it's less than $20 at most labs. And you only need to check it one time in your life for the most part. If it's low, it's always going to be low. If it's high, it's probably not going to change much from that baseline. There's some variance, but it has a pretty set genetic set point. And it's one of those things where it's like LDL particles, but with that extra protein on the outside of it, it allows it to dig into that endothelial glycocalyx a little bit easier. So it damages the glycocalyx. It gets stuck there. There's some debate on what exactly the function of Lpa was, but it has an effect on your clotting abilities. So maybe it was conserved in our gene pool because it helped certain mothers not bleed to death during childbirth. And maybe that's why there's 1 in 5 people of us carrying this stuff around. But it's thought of as a scavenger molecule. It's eating up all these oxidized phospholipids. So it's kind of like a garbage truck. I don't think they know exactly how the lipoprotein(a) particles get out of circulation. There's probably some receptor on the liver that they haven't fully elucidated, or maybe it eventually jams itself into an LDL receptor and is able to get out. But if that lipoprotein(a), which is like a garbage truck full of oxidized phospholipids, makes its way into your intima, we basically now have a nuclear bomb in your artery wall that sets off this huge inflammatory cascade. And so anytime I see somebody who has a high calcium score test in their 40s, or they've already had an event, unfortunately, I'm always looking at that first because, you know, if you're guessing by stats, 1 in 5 of those people are going to have a high level.
Yeah, just so people remember, mine was 25, I think we saw earlier. Normal. And I wanted to mention earlier that something we touched on in the podcast, I did have a CT or a CAC score. So I had a calcium score, not as good as a CT coronary angio, but I had a coronary artery calcium score in 2020, and it was 0. At that point, I was 42 or 43, I believe. And interestingly, you know, my father had an angioplasty when he was about that age. So I certainly have a family history of accelerated coronary artery disease. At that point in my life, my LDL was 500, but my CAC was 0. I probably should have another one. I don't want to do them that often. There's a small amount of radiation. I'd like to get a CT coronary angio. What do you recommend for people who have a genetically high LP little a? This kind of baffles me a little bit. I think there must be more to this story going on. You know, maybe it's if you have a genetically high LP little a and you're doing something negative in your lifestyle, or is this just a really bad poker hand? I can't parse it out.
It's very interesting. And just, you know, over the 10 years I've been a cardiologist, I've, you know, had hundreds of patients with LP little a, so you kind of get to see the natural course of it. There's some instances where LPA is the fire that's, you know, driving the plaque formation. And there's other people that have excessively high LPA and they don't have, you know, events. They don't have high calcium scores or CT angios. So what is the differentiator? In my estimation, it's probably more that those people don't have endothelial dysfunction. They don't have, you know, those markers that LPPLA2. If that LPPLA2 is elevated, that tends to mean that that lipoprotein A particle is going to have a lot of, you know, toxic waste in it. And then if you can assess either the oxidized LDL or preferably the oxidized phospholipid on ApoB, if that's elevated, then it's kind of like fire and dynamite. You think that LPA is probably pretty metabolically active at that point. So those are the people I can put in the super high risk bucket. But here's where it gets kind of disconcerting. There's no great treatments for lipoprotein A at this point. You know, people want to use niacin. Maybe niacin has a 10%, maybe 20% reduction in it, but you really got to get to be like 90% more reduction to really have a clinical benefit. You know, there's drugs in development. They're called antisense oligonucleotides. Right. They essentially work in the liver by turning off the machinery that puts on that corkscrew protein onto an LDL particle. And so the numbers drop by like 95%. So they show that it can drop it to almost, you know, undetectable. What they're currently doing in phase 3 trials is figuring out, are people going to have less events? You know, are they going to have less heart attacks, strokes, and such? You know, that's, you know, going to be wrapping up at the end of 2023, I believe. So if people have had multiple events and they have high lipoprotein A, well, there's probably something coming for you in a year or two that may be beneficial. But until the meantime, you just have to try to fix all the other things you can fix. Keep inflammation as low as possible. You know, reverse insulin resistance if it's present. Keep the oxidation under control. And then LPA probably doesn't have a lot of things to go out there to scavenge at that point.
So what I'm hearing, Mike, is that if your cardiologist is not doing fasting insulin, looking at your endothelial health, looking at your hsCRP, looking at your fasting blood glucose, looking at your LPPLA2, looking at your LP little a, probably looking at your ApoB and your particle number, screening you for thyroid disease, insulin sensitivity, like we talked about, and other things that they may not be getting the whole picture is what I consistently hear here. And I agree with that completely. And I think that, it's a great sadness of mine that most cardiology practice that I'm aware of today is quite myopic. It literally has blinders. Like they just get a lipid panel. What is your ApoB? That's what we do. And they're not getting all these other labs, are they? They're not really getting the whole picture.
Not generally. And I've been doing these, you know, advanced labs for 10 years in my practices. And, you know, up until 3 years ago, I was still rounding in the hospital, taking care of really sick people. But my passion was really kind of going through these advanced testing, explaining to people what's going on in their biochemistry, what they could do from a lifestyle standpoint, what they could supplement if needed, and then using the, you know, the pharmacological agents as needed, but trying to wean them off that when it was appropriate. You know, I won't fault my, you know, general cardiovascular colleagues. I mean, heart disease is still the number one thing taking people out. There's way too many people having heart attacks. I think the number's still like every 40 seconds, somebody's having a heart attack in, you know, the United States. So they're busy head down treating all these events and they're just throwing kitchen sinks at people. You know, I did, like I said, I recertified in my, you know, cardiovascular disease testing recently. There's new drugs that came out since the last time I was really using this stuff And there's amazing drugs that can keep people alive longer, but they're not necessarily going to be preventive. They're just putting Band-Aids on people at that point. And it's amazing that they're able to extend people's lives. But I always kind of talked about it like when I was in the cath lab. You know, it was amazing to be able to save people's lives, you know, right on the brink of them dying. But why do we have to wait so long? You know, why didn't we, you know, prevent Humpty Dumpties from falling off the wall in the first place? And so that's where my head's gone for the past few years is use these tests, use the endothelial function test to tell people this is what's going on right now. And if you make an intervention right now, you're not going to end up on our cath lab tables.
Western medicine doesn't do a very good job of that, man. No. So thanks for that. I appreciate what you're doing. I found this article. I just wanted to share it and see what you thought. So this one I thought was interesting. Have you seen this? Plasma Lp(a) levels in men and women consuming diets enriched in saturated cis or trans monounsaturated fatty acids. And the conclusion, the saturated diet lowered Lp(a) levels significantly by 8 to 11%. I thought that was interesting compared to the oleic diet. The trans diet had no adverse effects on Lp(a) levels when all subjects were considered collectively. So they say, thus, in amounts commonly found in the U.S. diet, saturated fatty acids can consistently decrease Lp(a). The adverse effects of replacing cis with trans fatty acids are only suggestive and restricted to high trans intakes in subjects with high Lp(a) levels. I'm pretty sure this headline didn't make the news. Imagine that. What if saturated fat is good for humans?
Right, or not as negative as people are demonizing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would make sense that having some saturated fat in your diet could create a more stable particle, less fatty acids in the particle to become oxidized. But that was the one thing that I'd heard about that could lower Lp(a) was increasing saturated fat. Now, that's from the AHA. I mean, that's what journal is that? That's Arteriosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology. That is a mainstream cardiovascular journal. And here they're saying saturated fat can lower your Lp(a), guys. So again, that might be what we've come back to. You know, if your grandmother couldn't eat it, or your great-grandmother, or your great-great-grandmother probably, then you probably shouldn't eat it. And guess what? None of our great-great-grandmothers were eating seed oils. They were all eating animal fat. So yeah, I think that that's a reasonable thing. You can take that to your cardiologist. Anyone listening to this who has an elevated Lp(a), you should probably go see Dr. Twyman in St. Louis. But if you can't do that and you have that problem, you can take this article to your cardiologist and say, maybe I should eat more butter.
Right.
And then let me know what they say. You mentioned something earlier that I want to close on, which is mitochondrial health. And then maybe we can just, before we close, reiterate all the things people can do to kind of protect their endothelium, because that seems to be ground zero for all of this. But how do you think about mitochondrial health, and how do you think people can really optimize that as well?
Sure. So I talk about mitochondria being more than just the powerhouse of the cells, but I know that's what most people think of them as. But your mitochondria are the organelles in your cells that make energy for you. Without energy, you're not alive. The two organs that are the energy hogs are your brain and heart. And it's been, you know, in my estimation and readings, that up to 1/3 of the mass of your heart is made up of mitochondria. You know, you've seen EKGs in your life. You know, did you ever wonder why an EKG was actually ever, you know, what those lines were from? It's from the, you know, basically the electric and magnetic energy that's coming out of your mitochondria. So your heart is mostly mitochondria. If you have weak mitochondria, you're going to develop a cardiomyopathy, a weak heart, you know, either systolic where the heart doesn't squeeze well, or diastolic where the heart doesn't relax well. And it actually takes more energy for the heart to relax than it does to squeeze. So you inherit your mitochondria only from your mother. So your mother is kind of your starting, you know, point to look at. You know, if your mom, your grandma on that side were really healthy, you're less likely to break down. But if your mom and her mom had heart disease early on, had cancers, had autoimmune conditions, all those are signs that they had weaker mitochondria, that maybe that's what you started with. So it's mostly about thinking about your mitochondria as engines. You know, food is a fuel for that engine. Sometimes we all get stuck in the weeds of thinking like, we got to put in all this super organic premium gas into our engines. Well, that's ideal, but if you have a really crappy engine, it doesn't matter how good the fuel is. You have to make the engine work better. And most of the things that make the engine work better is optimizing your sleep, because that's when the mitochondria repair themselves. They do autophagy, which is kind of like doing the dishwasher at night, and then you have clean dishes in the morning. Or they do apoptosis. This mitochondria engine shot, we got to build you a whole new engine. It takes a lot of energy to put in new engines into circulation. So sleep is mission critical, like if you want to have longevity. But how do you get the mitochondria to function properly? You really got to listen to your circadian biology. You know, there's a 24-hour cycle of how your hormones and neurotransmitters get made. It's mostly programmed by the light that enters your eyes and hits your skin, but also by the timing your nutrients come in. So your liver and gut really pay attention to the time that the nutrients come in. So I usually tell my patients, for the most part, you want to stop eating 3 to 4 hours before you go to sleep so that your liver and gut know that it's nighttime and they flip into repair mode. You know, you're in Costa Rica. You have much more light stability. You know, your days are going to be more similar than mine right now. I got like four seasons. We're entering winter here in St. Louis. So the mitochondria are always sensing the light environments. That helps them determine how much energy they're going to produce. So focusing on your circadian biology, getting the proper sleep, those are the first signs. And then you can check in all these kind of fancy labs to figure out, is there anything that's poisoning the mitochondria?
For fancy labs, would you look at like organic acids, or what other kind of fancy labs would you think of?
That would look at some of the organic acids, but you know, look at CoQ10 levels, look at oxidative stress, you know, inflammation, all those things are going to be damaging to the mitochondria.
Yeah. CoQ10 is an interesting one. I mean, were you taught to check CoQ10 levels in your patients in your fellowship for cardiology?
No.
I wonder how many physicians who give their patients statins, and I'm not saying that statins are a bad thing. Like we talked about earlier, there are certainly people in whom they are indicated. And I think that that population is especially a population that can't or won't make lifestyle change. But I wonder how many physicians who are actually giving patients statins, which we know are going to inhibit the production of coenzyme Q10, are going to check the coenzyme Q10 levels in their patients. I mean, this is a critical component of the mitochondrial electron transport chain. Right. When I've checked my CoQ10, it's been very high, presumably because I eat lots of heart. Yeah. You know, heart is super high in CoQ10, and muscle meat is pretty high in CoQ10 also. So yeah, I wish more people checked CoQ10. Amazing. Anything else that we didn't touch on that you really want to let people know about? Tie it in a bow for us. How can people keep their endothelial function good?
Sure.
And we'll wrap it up.
Sure. Well, first off, I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to speak to your audience.
Yeah, man.
You know, I'm very passionate about heart attack prevention. You know, I treated way too many heart attacks and seen people leave life way earlier than they should have. And if you really take control of your health, you don't have to be one of those statistics. So it really starts first with endothelial health. That's mostly about how much your body can make nitric oxide. Exercises can improve nitric oxide. Being where you're at, getting a lot of UVA light, hitting your skin, it's going to make nitric oxide. If you eat vegetables, it's mostly going to be the dark leafy green vegetables helping boost it. There's certain supplements that can boost it, but you know, don't have to start with the supplementation. Do the things that are free first. There's non-invasive tests that can tell you, are your arteries elastic? You know, what is your blood pressure? All those are markers of endothelial health. One thing I didn't get into this thing, and maybe we can do it offline at some point, but the CT coronary calcium scan is a great starting point for most people over the age of 40. Think of it almost as like a mammogram for the heart. Calcium is supposed to be in your bones and teeth. If calcium is building up in the artery walls, that indicates that you got plaque in the artery walls. The calcium isn't so much the problem. That's kind of the last stage of the body trying to repair the damage to that fatty streak and soft plaque. It's that softer plaque that sits on top of the hard plaque that you're worried about. That soft plaque can be like a volcano ready to blow. And the calcium score test, while good, isn't perfect. So you can add other tests. You can look at a carotid intimal medial thickness test, which is an ultrasound of your neck on your arteries or your artery on the side of your neck. If there's thickening of that artery, you have inflammation in the artery, or if you have soft plaque in the artery, whatever's going on there is very likely going on in your coronary arteries as well. And then there's a novel test coming online over the past year called the Clearly CT angiogram. So CT angiograms are usually utilized to assess patients who are having symptoms. They're having chest pain, exercise intolerance. You know, they get an IV, they squirt the contrast in their vein, goes over to the other side of the heart, lights up the coronary arteries, and you see how much blockage or stenosis in their artery. That's great, but stenosis isn't the whole story. Stenosis are called symptoms, but stenosis doesn't always cause a heart attack. The benefit of the Clearly test is that it will actually assess the plaque characteristics. It will tell you not only how much hard plaque is there, but how much soft plaque, but more importantly, how much low-density soft plaque. That's the stuff that's like kryptonite in your artery wall. That's the stuff you're really worried about. And those are the people that maybe statins are more useful for. Yeah, those are the people that you got to be more aggressive for. So for the people who are doing a carnivore diet or a keto diet and their LDL-C is 500, you know, I don't automatically freak out if it's high. I want to know, do you have healthy endothelium? But if you do one of these CT angios and it looks at your arteries and you don't have a lot of soft plaque in your artery, then that LDL-C isn't as big a concern to you. But if you're building up a lot of soft plaque in your artery that hasn't yet calcified and you're going around saying, I have a calcium score of 0, but my LDL-C is 500, you still may have a very big problem.
And you should probably do something like the CT coronary angio, like the Clearly CT. Yeah, I want to do one of those. I'll just mention that Dave Feldman, citizen scientist, mm-hmm. a previous engineer who I've had on the podcast multiple times, is doing a study with a really well-respected CT coronary angiographer, really, cardiac radiologist. What's that? Matt Budoff. And Dave put out a video on YouTube, and they were talking about the preliminary results. So basically what the study he's doing is they're taking people who are lean mass hyper-responders, predominantly people on low-carb ketogenic diets. My audience will know that I'm sort of plus minus on those. I don't think they're necessary for all people. I like to eat fruit. But a lot of times, probably because of what Dave has described with this energy model, LDL will go quite high on a ketogenic diet for lean mass hyper-responders. This is Dave's verbiage. Mine certainly went 300, at one time 500. Like I said, now it's 175, but most physicians would still look at my LDL and say it's high. But they took these people and they were lean mass hyper-responders with high LDLs. I think it's between, they have people probably between 200 and 400 who have been on the diet for a long time. And they did entrance CT coronary angiography. And what's interesting, and they talk about this, is that the amount of atherosclerosis on that CT coronary angiography, at least at the onset of the study, was much lower than Matt Budoff, Dr. Budoff would have expected based on those levels of LDL. Now, the full study is to follow them for 6 months to a year and see what the progression is, because the fact that people who are lean mass hyper-responders have atherosclerosis, it's very rare, but some of them do. We don't know what they've been exposed to in the past. Mm-hmm. They probably weren't all eating this diet from the day they were born, et cetera. So there's lots of variables. What's really going to be interesting is how much this plaque progresses, because I know that Matt Budoff's pre-test hypothesis was that, hey, if your LDL is 300, you should progress very quickly with that plaque. And we will see that plaque progress, within a year on your CT coronary angiogram. And so I think Dave is an investigator and didn't really want to talk about his hypotheses, mm-hmm. but my hypothesis would have been, hey, if these people have healthy endothelium, like we talked about, it's the LDL particles, even though there's a lot of them, these ApoB are probably just going to slide right by. And I don't think we're going to see the progression that we would expect on these people. So that study will be another year or two out for the results, but at least the preliminary results were really interesting, that just based on the people who had already been eating this diet, they didn't have nearly what Matt Budoff would have expected for their atherosclerotic burden. Did you see that stuff? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I knew that they were starting the trial. I hadn't seen that preliminary data. That's very interesting. And yeah, I'll definitely be looking for the follow-up studies. And that's the whole analogy of, the test don't guess philosophy, the biohackers, the end of one people is, you can eat whatever you want to eat, but know what your baseline is and know what, things you're actually trying to measure. If it's how much endothelial dysfunction you got or how much plaque you have, well, you want to know what that is at baseline. They make your dietary intervention and then recheck at whatever time frame is appropriate. I often get that question, is plaque reversible? Yes. But the first goal is don't have an event. Don't let those plaques rupture. Second is stabilize them. Third is potentially get them to start regressing.
But that's a really important point. I'm glad you brought that up. That's a huge hope for many people to say plaque regression happens. I have people reach out to me all the time, and sometimes they reach out with very high calcium scores, and I say, I'm not a cardiologist, right. Go see your cardiologist. But they say, do you think plaque regression is possible? And if I respond, I might say, I mean, it's been documented in the past. I have no doubt that the human body could heal these things. And intuitively, I think in my mind, when I get a scab on my knee, the body heals it. Like I think of atherosclerosis, I think of these plaques as a process of repair. And that when they become, like you said, these zits or these festering, inflamed things, there's something impairing that repair or continuing to damage and irritate the tissue. If you can create a situation in your artery wall, the most valuable knee and elbow that you have in your body, quote unquote, where the body can just repair that scar, repair that wound, I think it's very possible that could happen.
Oh yeah. And clinically, I've definitely seen it. I mean, especially with the carotid scan, seeing the intima shrink, seeing soft plaque shrink over a year, definitely possible. The endothelial function get better. See that max pulse go from a type 6, which is a very, very stiff artery, back down to a type 2. The calcium score test, a little bit different. I've seen a few patients whose calcium scores have been in the, double digits and seen it go back to zero. But I always tell people that's not necessarily the goal. Calcium is just a marker that there's plaque there, and it's probably a stabilizing factor. So the goal is not to see your calcium score test getting significantly worse. But the one caveat I want to leave the audience with is that, you know, if your calcium score is, quote, elevated, whatever that means for your population, if you go on a statin, it's very likely your calcium score test is going to go up. So if you have an abnormal calcium score and you start a treatment, you may not ever want to really repeat the calcium score test because you, if you don't know how to interpret it, you're going to think you're getting worse. So if you start with a calcium score of zero and you're on treatment for lipids for whatever reason, sure, repeat the calcium score test 3 years later, 5 years later, whatever. Is your score still zero? Good. But if you have a calcium score over 400, you're a high-risk individual. Repeating the scan isn't going to add anything to that. It's kind of those people in that middle zone, 1 to 399. But if you do nothing, your calcium score test can continue to probably increase by about 20% a year. If you add a statin, often that soft plaque will solidify and turn into a hard plaque, and then your calcium score test goes up.
And in that case, it seems like you'd want to have a CT coronary angio to really fill in the data on like what's happening to your plaques, and rather than being confused with the CAC.
Correct. And that's why, you know, I'm still going to recommend the calcium score test because it's more readily available for most people. It's usually relatively inexpensive. It's usually about $100. And again, it's like a mammogram for the heart. It's not a lot of radiation. So I'm not concerned that people, you know, are going to, you know, develop, you know, malignancies from one calcium score. But, you know, if you do a CT angiogram every year, I'm a little more concerned about the amount of radiation a CT angiogram would entail. So the CT angio is for the right population. You know, you're a little bit more risk averse. You don't necessarily want to take statin therapy, or, you know, your calcium score is zero, but you have other risk factors. I've seen numerous people with calcium scores of zero who go do the CT angiogram and get the clear analysis. They still have zero calcification in the plaque, but they still have at least mild amount of soft plaque in their coronary arteries. So the risk is probably a little bit higher than they knew. And so maybe they're going to be a little bit more aggressive with certain lifestyle modifications. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean they got to jump on statins or prescriptions, but they're not zero risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know off the top of your head, I remember when I looked, when I got my CAC, I looked at how many millisieverts a coronary artery calcium scan was versus the clearly CT.
So like a calcium score test is, I believe, about approximately like, you know, 10 chest x-rays, you know, but a CT angiogram, depending on the institution, you know, it's going to be, you know, probably a little shy of 8 to 10 millisieverts, but that's much less than, you know, a nuclear stress test. You know, nuclear stress tests are going to be 20 plus millisieverts. And I believe the data is that you generally want to have less than 50 millisieverts of radiation in a year. And just living on Earth, you're getting about 1 to 2 millisieverts a year.
Yeah. And I think in the original metric that you said, a chest x-ray is usually about 0.1 millisieverts, right? So 10 of those would be 1 millisievert for a CAC scan, 8 to 10 millisieverts for a CT coronary angiogram. You're getting 1 to 2 millisieverts a year just living on Earth. A nuclear stress test, you said 20 millisieverts, quite a lot. Yeah. So that at that point, the radiation starts to build up. And that's a separate topic for a separate podcast. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom, Mike. Where can people find more of your stuff or reach out to you and connect with you if they want to learn more about what you're doing?
So people are interested in this type of topics, you know, endothelial function, mitochondrial health. I'm most active on Instagram. My handle is Dr. Twyman, DrTwyman. Also have a website, drtwyman.com, has links to my YouTube videos and other things that discuss these type of topics.
Do you see any patients virtually, or is it all in person in St. Louis? Do people need to come to St. Louis to work with you? Is your practice full? Is it open?
It is not full yet, but after being on Dr. Lyon's podcast and this one, might be full. But no, we do have patients coming from all over the country that will fly into St. Louis that will get the non-invasive testing in our office, the Max Pulse, the EndoPat. We didn't even get into it, but I have like an 8-foot-tall photobiomodulation panel in my office. So I teach them all about red light therapy. So we work with most patients in person, but I do work with some people remotely doing more educational second opinion consults where if they want to upload their labs like yours or your calcium score, I'll review it with them and then say, okay, these are the lifestyle things I think you could kind of improve on. And then if you haven't had certain labs or certain tests, tell them, okay, if you have a local doctor that can order this stuff, go get this testing with your local doctors then.
Yeah, probably the best thing would be for people to come to St. Louis if they could to see you in person, get an EKG, do the EndoPat, do the Max Pulse, do the endothelial testing and kind of go from there. And then maybe work remotely if that's an option for people. So yeah, I have a feeling you may have some interest after this podcast. Yeah. But thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
I love what you're doing. I appreciate your work in the world. And man, I hope we get to eat some steak at some point in the future.
That sounds great.